Welcome to the Oxygen Advantage co-hosting podcast, Robin.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
This is actually the first co-hosting podcast for me and Pat McEwen, the founder of the Oxygen Advantage. And the reason why we picked you today is because I played tennis, and you've had an unbelievable tennis career, but you've had a few bumps on the road. And I know that especially Patrick is an expert in breathing and anxiety and panic attacks and all that. And even after you kind of finished your tennis career, which had an unbelievable business career. So that's what we want to kind of talk about today.
Yeah.
If we start with a little bit about your background for the people that don't know how you started playing tennis and what it led up to your professional career.
Well, as a kid, I did a lot of different sports. You know, I played, obviously, of course, tennis. I played football, ice hockey, handball. I grew up in a small village called Tibro. It's only, I would say, 10,000-11,000 citizens, but everything was there and everything was so close. You know, I remember I could take my bike from school, and it took me 2 minutes to get to the tennis court or to the ice hockey rink or whatever. Everything was very convenient, and I was one of those kids, you know, that really liked sports. Basically all I did after school or you know, in the weekends was just doing sports with my friends, whether it was, you know, playing tennis or just playing football in the backyard. But I think I started to play tennis already when I was, that was actually the first sport I tried. I was only 4 years old. My dad used to play a few times a week. You know, this was in the mid 80s when tennis started to get extremely popular in Sweden. You know, we had so much success, a lot of good players. And then all of a sudden there were courts popping up in almost every village, and everybody played tennis. And that's how I started, or that's how my dad started. And I follow him, and I really liked it. As I said, I liked sport, all different kinds of sport, but tennis was actually the only individual sport that I tried. And I think that for some reason it suited my personality better than doing a team sport.
Yeah. And you started playing, well, competitive tennis at what age? When did you realize that you were very good at tennis?
Well, pretty early, you know, in my club, I always practiced with guys that were a few years older than me. Already when I was four, I started to practice with guys that were 7, 8 years old, and I could keep up with them. But I think I played the first Swedish national championship when I was 12, and I won it. And then, of course, you realize, okay, I'm number one in Sweden in my age group. And then I started to play international a little bit in Europe, and I did pretty well. And that's when I realized, you know, okay, this is a sport for me. And around the same time, you know, I started to give up all the other sport. It was just too much. Tennis became more and more. And I think I quit the handball when I was 13 or something, just to focus on tennis.
When did you quit school, by the way?
So after system is, as you know, a little bit different in Sweden. So after ninth grade, you know, you have to go to school for 9 years. But I always say that I'm not really sure that I did a full in ninth grade. You know, I looked back and I think, you know, I was only there 50% of the time. So already when I was 14, 15, I started to travel a lot, you know, played a lot of tournaments in Europe. So last one and a half years in school was difficult for me.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember actually when I saw you the first time, we saw also in team tennis in the Pittsburgh, and you were 15, I think. And you were one of those guys, you could see right away that you were going to be, you know, really big in tennis. There was no doubt about it. So luckily, again, I didn't play that time either, because that would have been, you know, beaten by a 15-year-old. So I saw right away. But then from 15, I mean, didn't you win the European Championships at that age? Or
when I was I was 18. I won the European Championship. No, I was 17.
Yeah.
And I won the Orange Bowl. So I think a lot of things happened for me between the age of 15 and 18. I moved to Gothenburg, which is Sweden's biggest city, you know, to practice with some older guys, better guys than me. And I improved a lot during those years. And, you know, I broke through on the ATP tour already when I was 18 or 19 years old. So everything happened really, really quick for me, which was, of course, nice. But also, you know, it was tough because all of a sudden, I was there, I was playing against the guys I had been watching on TV just a few years earlier. Everything was new, and all of a sudden I started to lose so much more than what I was used to. During my junior career, I won a lot, again, which was nice, but I never really learned how to cope with losses in a good way.
Yeah. So then it just kind of, I know you progressed through the rankings pretty fairly straightforward, moving up every year. And, you know, I guess as a tennis player, physically what it takes, I mean, you practice more, you see the older guys and so on, but then I guess the older you got on the ATP tour, you start traveling. So what type of mindset does it take? I mean, to be on the tour, I mean, it's physically very demanding, but I think, I mean, mentally in tennis, yeah, it's very, very demanding also. So how was that transition, you know, start traveling worldwide?
I mean, it was in the beginning, it was just great. You know, everything was new. Everything was just fantastic. You know, as I said, I played against my idols and I started to beat them. But after a while, it gets pretty pretty taxing. You know, as you said, tennis is a tough sport because there's no real off season. Like you see in many other sports, you know, you have a few months break before a new season. You know, in tennis, we had, and the guys still have, only a couple of weeks, you know, for them to rest, recover, and start to prepare for a new season. And that was tough. And also, I think the ranking system, you know, you always have to defend points. So at least for me, it was after a while, I started to feel chased, you know. As I said, in the beginning, everything was new. Everything was for me up for grabs. Everything was for me to win. The better I became, the higher I climbed the rankings, you know, I felt the more I had to lose. So it's, for me, as you said, the physical part is like in any, I would say in any sport, you know, being a top athlete, it's extremely, extremely tough physically, but also for me, the mental part was the biggest challenge for me.
Yeah, because
sorry, Daniel, if I could step in, because this this is the field that I think is really the crucial part of it, and I also think it's the field that's often overlooked.
Yeah,
because there's an idea out there that somebody who is an athlete that they should be, you know, very well able to cope mentally, but there's a few things here. One was you said that you weren't able to deal with losing, or you hadn't been experiencing it before, and that was something new. And I think this is something that we all face in our everyday life. And when we were growing up, I'm probably the same age as you guys, because I remember tennis becoming so popular during the 1980s as well. You know, so I think when we were growing up as well, and I don't want to go too much off topic, we had disappointments. And we had plenty of them. And by the time we were 18 and 19 and 20, we were a little bit more resilient, not at a level to the point that we had disappointments in sports. But I often just feel, even just today with children and teenagers, that's one aspect of it, that there is something there that's very important in training us to handle disappointments. I don't know, do you still work in tennis or do you coach in tennis? I think Daniel mentioned you did. What do you say to the youngsters coming up through the ranks? How do you prepare them? What have you learned from your experience?
I mean, for me, as you said, you know, I had, as traveling professional, you know, I had a team with me. I had a really good physical coach, tennis trainer. I knew exactly what to eat, how to train, when to rest physically. But no one really told me, like, how do you deal with all this mentally? You know, I went to a few sports psychologists, but everything was so focused on how do you perform, how do you, to make you perform even more. And that was not my problem. I always played my best tennis under pressure, but what was really difficult for me was to try to not mix myself as a person with me as a tennis player. You know, I remember when I played well, I felt great, life was great, you know, but if I lost a few matches, I felt like a terrible person. You know, and now a few years later, you know, after I retire, I look back and I see, why did I care so much? It was just hitting a yellow ball over a net. But to me, it was so difficult. To me, that was really all that matters. And I think in one way, it's good because it took me a long way. You know, I never had any problems training hard. I never had any, you know, I did all the sacrifices. I would do anything just to become a better tennis player. But also in the long run, it's really hard for you. You know, I was resting physically, but I was never really resting mentally. Even, you know, I had a rest day, I could be laying on the couch, you know, resting physically, but I was thinking about next match, next practice. Oh, what would happen, you know, next week I have a semifinals to defend. What would happen if I lose first round? I will go down from number 5 to number 6 in the world. You know, it was always this. I think if I would do it again, I would try to maybe focus on something else than just to have something else in my life apart from tennis. You know, for me, my whole life basically was tennis. You know, everything, every decision I took was based on, is this good or bad for my tennis? And I think that's the way also I've been told that you have to be as a professional. I think, you know, in tennis and in many sports, you know, it's just that the one who trains hardest, the one who can train an extra hour, an extra day, do a little bit more is rewarded. You never really reward someone that says, okay, this is okay, you know, I need some rest.
But that's and a great
it works. Yeah, it works short time. But for me, you know, playing as a professional, a career is, even though it's pretty short, it's still, you know, at least 10, 15 years. And it's tough if you're gonna keep it that way for so many years.
Yeah. How do you, I mean, like you said, you have everything with the physical part, when to recover, everybody knows that and so on, but the mental part. So you were always on, even from a young age, always on mentally.
Yeah.
They're always drained mentally. Physically, I think most people can handle the burden. Most,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
if you get injured, you rest and you, but mine, plus you don't, this was maybe 2005, 2010, that how, did you ever get exposed to somebody talking to you about breathing methods, how to sleep, even mindfulness at that stage, anything like that to kind of
nothing. I mean, of course, everybody said that, okay, sleeping is good, I understand that sleeping is good, but that's basically it. I think a lot of things happened in the last, you know, maybe five years. Mm-hmm. And not only in sports, you know, I have a lot of friends that worked really hard, they're successful people. And you know, it doesn't really matter if you work in another field or if you're an athlete. You know, it's the same thing. You know, if you don't get the proper recovery, sooner or later you will find yourself in a really difficult situation, I think.
But do you think you could have been as good as you were, because you were on your way to winning Grand Slams? You had 2 Grand Slam finals in maybe the toughest tournament, the French Open. To view tennis as only a yellow ball and only to have, you know, distance to tennis and still be so good. Everything is focused around tennis. So can you have both ways? Can you be
it's a good question. I'd really like to think so. You know, I think that when you're on court, when you're playing a match, when you train, you always have to be there 100%, give it 100%. But the really difficult part is to know how to switch on and switch off during matches or after matches, you know, between practices. And I really never found a way to do that. Not that I was really looking for it, because in my whole career, I was just, you know, all the obstacles, all the, all, all the, and the setbacks I had, you know, I was able to get over them by just pushing a little bit harder. And it worked for many, many years. But it was just that all of a sudden it didn't work anymore. And when I look back, you know, it feels like this happened to me, you know, in 1 or 2 days. But now looking back, I can see that I was not feeling good for the last, you know, probably 2-3 years of my career. But if someone would have asked me back then, how do you feel? I would say, I feel great. And I would honestly mean it. And so I was really, you know, I never really listened to my body. You know, I wasn't taking any notice about the signals my body gave me. And I was just pushing harder and harder. And then all of a sudden it was just, you know, I just couldn't do it anymore.
That is amazing, because the last 2 or 3 years, especially last year, is when you played, I mean, the last year, the best tennis. I mean,
But I thought I felt great. You know, it's just now I feel like, okay, I wasn't feeling good at all. But, you know, you get so good at just pushing away all the symptoms. And I was just looking forward all the time.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Robin, I think it is something with the human mind in terms of when we're overthinking, and it's certainly something that's going to be with perfectionist tendencies and type A personalities and high achievers. Mm. And it's okay to be thinking a lot, but I think you put it there that we really need to be able to switch off.
Yeah.
And it's not just by switching off by taking on another hobby, because that's only changing one distraction for another.
Yeah.
But it's actually observing the mind. But even using, for example, I came across breathwork 20 years ago. And for me, it totally changed my life, because I had a racing mind. Most people have a racing mind. You never openly tell people that you have a racing mind.
No.
But I remember just focusing on my breathing and changing my breathing as well. Breathing through the nose, breathing light, breathing slow, breathing deep. And it helped to bring a calmness. And really where it helped was with my sleep. And I think part of the reason that I had a racing mind was because of two things. One was I was mouth breathing during sleep every night. I had an undiagnosed sleep disorder. I was waking up tired. But the second was I had faster upper chest breathing. And I see this even in elite athletes.
Yeah.
And it's not being addressed. And I think the funny thing here is you mentioned you had a nutritionist, you have a strength and conditioning coach, you have a full team of people around you. And even when it talked with Headspace, maybe a psychologist is talking about how to keep going better and better and better.
Exactly.
But how not, we need to be able to create that space. And we also need to be able to train the brain that we want to focus upon what we want to focus on.
Yeah.
Timothy Galloway wrote a great book. It's really amazing that it didn't get into tennis, because I know he wrote a book on the inner game of golf back in 1973. And he wrote a book on the inner game of tennis. And it would have been in the late 70s. And I read that book just a few years ago. And it's all about putting the critical mind aside so that the real energy can come out. Mm. And that's what we need to, that tool. But that's something I suppose we learn with practice. It's starting to come out there now. But in terms of breathing and the power of it, in being able to improve sleep quality, and the elephant in the room here with sleep is breathing through the nose. It's people will talk about sleep hygiene and make sure your room is dark and make sure that everything is sound and don't be looking at your mobile phone and wear blue light filter glasses and all this. Nasal breathing is without a shadow of the doubt. And I would say that anybody who wakes up with a dry mouth in the morning, they're not likely to wake up feeling refreshed, and they're more likely to be having snoring and obstructive sleep apnea. So for me anyway, the sleep is a fundamental part of it in terms of performance. And then the ability to concentrate, the ability to train the brain, regardless of distractions, and the ability to switch off. And I think sometimes, and I'll stop talking in a moment, breathing has had a bad rap over the years because it was something that was done by a bunch of hippies. And there's no offense against, you know, but that's the idea that's out there, that you have to have all of these beads and these white robes and you have to be, whatever mantra you have, you know, breathing is about performance. And I think we have to put away the idea in terms of the breadth, that it's not just left off field, that it's something that's intangible in human performance. Because without concentration, we don't have the ability to have 100% of our attention in doing what we are doing. And respiratory physiology, like, you know, we've come across hundreds of people prone to panic disorders. And when I look at their everyday breathing, they typically breathe a little bit faster, a little bit upper chest, and a little bit irregular. Mm-hmm. And all it takes is a little bit of stress to tip them over the edge. And if we change everyday functional breathing patterns, it gives us resilience. And I know you talked about recovery there, and heart rate variability is a great measurement, and it's an objective and clinical measurement of stress. We can improve that. But I still think, or the question that I'm going to put to you is, are people really looking at breathing now? Has it started to come into the domain of high performance in sports?
I think all these type of things has starting to come in the last few years, and breathing is one of the things, but it takes time. For some reason, it's more difficult for athletes and people to think or to incorporate these things into their daily training regime. You know, if there's a new exercise in the gym, everybody would try it the next day. This mm-hmm. takes longer, and I don't know if there's also, I think there's still, even though it's better, I think there's still about a little stigma about speaking about how you feel mentally, like mental health and everything. But since more and more people all around the world, not only athletes, is struggling with this, you know, people are starting to speak about it more, which is great, I think. You know, because when I felt bad, you know, in the beginning, of course, I thought, you know, I was going crazy. But then after a while, I realized this is, even though it's in one way mentally, it's so physically, my whole body was just, you know, upside down. And, you know, when I realized that, you know, I had so many injuries, and this was, you know, in one way, one of all the other injuries, it was just feeling a little bit different. It was easier for me to handle everything.
I was
just going to ask you a question, Robin. What, I mean, in 2011, when you played your last match, I mean, if somebody had come to you at that point, and I know you won Swedish Open, you crushed everybody and said, well, you need to take a step back. You need to focus on recovery, your sleep, your whole regimen needs to be completely revised because it's not good for you. Would there been a way to reach somebody like you? Like if you move up 10 years now and talk to the number 5 in the world, is there a way to reach that person before the fact?
I don't think I would have listened. You know, I traveled with the fitness coach, and he was basically the only one speaking to me a little bit about this, but it must have been extremely difficult for him to reach out to me. You know, I just wouldn't listen. I would say, you know, I don't have time for recovery. Yeah. That would probably be my response. And you know, I think that throughout the years, it got a little bit worse and worse every year, but really slow. So I didn't really notice it. You know, and I would probably tell them like, I know I will, after my career, I will rest a lot. And sometimes, you know, when I played, that's how I felt. You know, I was 26, 28, 27, 28. And I was thinking, okay, I was playing my best tennis. I was number 4 in the world. And I found myself sometimes, you know, thinking that how many years more do I have to do this? You know, I was thinking, okay, when does normally a player retire? Oh, okay, 34, 35. Okay, keep going another 6-7 years. I didn't really like it. And also, you know, I felt really guilty about it because as a kid growing up, my biggest dream was to be a professional tennis player. And an even bigger dream was to be a top player in the world playing Grand Slam finals. And I was there and I felt that, you know, I was not happy. It was nothing near what I had expected. And, you know, I think in one way that made everything a little bit worse.
Yeah, that's amazing, Daniel. And thanks, or sorry, Robin, thanks very much for being so forthright. I think sometimes that's human nature. We put so much pressure on ourselves. Yeah. And it's because we're setting everything into the future that we're, yeah, we are here, but we want to be over there.
Mm.
And we're putting all of our resources to getting to that goal. Mm. And once we reach the goal, we have it. It still can lead to some disappointment. But I think, Daniel, your question earlier on, I think it's because the wording is wrong. That if somebody was to approach Robin when he was 20 years of age or 18 and say, you need to be recovering, we can kind of understand it, can't we? But maybe if somebody was to approach Robin and say, Robin, I need to improve your breathing. I need to improve your focus and your concentration. In other words, as opposed to, because I don't think as men we want to admit that we have a racing mind. We go down to the pub when we have a racing mind. You know, 10 or 11 pints of Guinness soon gets rid of a racing mind.
Yeah.
It doesn't deal with the issue, but that's, we like, it's, you know, both men and female, we have our own ways of dealing with it. And a lot of people will resort to self-medication to deal with a racing mind.
Mm.
However, the very issues that are causing a racing mind are also impacting mental performance in terms of concentration, attention, and focus and resilience. Yeah. And I think that's where we need to be going. And it was like, there was Scott McGee is a sergeant from Santa Monica, really great guy. And he's a SWAT. So he's, you know, he's well up in terms of in police force. And he said, he talked about, he'd love to be bringing mindfulness into the police department. And I'm saying, Scott, whatever you do, don't call it mindfulness. You call it anything other than that. Does that make sense? So
yeah, friends,
it's really about framing it and reframing yeah, it to get it yeah, out there.
Yeah, you know, if someone would have come up to me and said, yo, you should try this, I think you would, I'm pretty sure you would become a better tennis player. You know, at least I would give it a try and to see. And again, you know, I didn't realize I had a racing mind or if I was, or that I was anxious, you know, because you kind of get used to it. I didn't know how should I feel? What's good? What's normal? What's bad? You know, I didn't really know. And I was, as you said, I was so far ahead in my mind, you know, straight after a match, I was thinking about next match, you know, next practice, next. And it becomes, you know, you can live like that for a short period of time, no problem. But when you have that day after day, year after year, that's and with no real recovery or rest, that's when it become really dangerous, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you had that 2011, you played your last match, and that's almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So now it's very, very interesting because how did you recover? And you, I know you got into like a lot of business. I mean, Stockholm Open director, mm-hmm, you know, coaching, Davis Cup captain, your own company, RS Tennis. So you got even more things, so to speak, going on today in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that transition? What happened from 2011 up to today, so to speak?
I mean, in the beginning, I was feeling so bad, so sick, you know. I during my career, I got pretty used to, you know, having pains and aches and everything. But this was just something different. I was feeling extremely bad for a long, long time. I went from, you know, playing best of five set matches on clay, and a week later, I couldn't even walk up a stair. And I had horrible anxiety, panic attacks, and all this. And the thing is, I did so many mistakes because I didn't really change anything. I was just, in the beginning, I was just looking for a doctor who could give me a pill, you know, and then I would just wake up the day after and continue with my life. You know, it took a long time before I really understood and before I really realized what this was. And I think the recovery didn't really start to speed up until I understood what had happened to me, and before I started to change my my own values and started to change my life in a better way. But it took time. It took many years before I felt 100% good again. But the thing is, now sometimes I feel even better now than before this happened to me. You know, sometimes some days I have this thought that I recognize this feeling. This was something I had as a kid. You know, and then it's great, but I do everything in a different way now. I would never, you know, I always try my best, but I do it in a different way. I would never go up in something. I would never worry as much as I did before. But that would be pretty difficult for me to learn before I went through this. You know, it's just a shame that I had to go through all this just to understand and just to know how to live a healthier and happy life.
Seems like you created that distance now that you know where the boundaries are. But did you get in, like, did anybody, or did you self-teach yourself, like, within sleeping, or it could be, like, whatever, mindfulness or breathing technique? Yeah. Or cold bath? Did you do all any of that?
I did all this. And the thing is, in the beginning, it was difficult because I couldn't sleep. You know, I had unbelievable sleeping problems with anxiety. And also I tried the mindfulness. I tried the breathing technique. But in the beginning, it didn't work for me because I was feeling so sick. Mm. And so I just couldn't relax for 5 seconds. But now I still do these things. You know, I prioritize sleep a lot. I do the breathing exercises. I do mindfulness. And now I really feel it helps a lot. I get kind of addicted to it, and it started to help me after, you know, 1 or 2 years, you know, when I started to feel a little bit better, at least good enough, you know, I could relax, I could lay down for 10 minutes and really do it. But I think also it's like everything else, the more you do it, the better you became. And for me, it's not like, it doesn't work if I decide to do 1 hour of breathing exercises or mindfulness once a week. For me, it's much better if I do it, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes every day to get the routine going. So it's really something that I try to incorporate in my daily life.
Do you have you used like aura rings, like a bio wearable or anything like that to kind of track your sleep and all that?
Yes, I used Oura Ring for a long time. I lost it though. In the summer. I was taking a swim and I lost it, and I didn't buy a new one yet. But I really have to do it because it was extremely helpful, especially checking up on my sleep. You know, I started to realize things that, you know, I would drink a beer and I saw it in the night. I would drink one beer and I didn't feel anything. I thought the sleep was great, but I saw that the sleep was not as good as if I wouldn't have drank a beer, you know, and I saw what was really affecting me. You know, many things you feel that it's affecting you, but when it's not affecting you, you know, a lot straight away, this Oura Ring helped me a lot to realize, okay, I could get it on paper, you know, okay, this is affecting me. If I do this, this is helping the sleep. And it's a really good tool.
Yeah, I think Daniel, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that when the mind is very anxious or in turmoil, it's very difficult to practice mindfulness.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, Robin, I think mindfulness is not suitable for the people who can need it most. Because I know myself, and also with people that we've worked with over the years, when the mind is really racing,
yeah,
it's very frustrating to start focusing on the breath. Yeah. But there are simple little breathing exercises, including breath holding. Because, and the only reason I'm going to say this is, most people believe that the harder and faster you breathe, the more blood flow and oxygen gets to the brain. But it's not true. And I'll give you an example. I was doing, I went to Uppsala University in Sweden for 1 year. So I'm familiar with your lovely country. And as part of my finals in a university in Dublin, I had an exam and I was very anxious going into the exam. And I went for a walk for 2 minutes and I started taking these full big breaths because I thought it was going to calm me down. So I went into the exam hall. I was completely spaced out and lightheaded. It was the wrong thing to do. And if I was to do it again, because I can imagine the amount of people, because there is an idea out there, not all breathing exercises are the same. And a lot of people are teaching breathing exercises and the exercises have no basis in physiology. And I've made plenty of mistakes with breathing exercises. There's a lot of depth to it too, but there are simple tools, even by breathing in, breathing out and holding the nose for a few seconds, breathing normally, holding the nose, breathing normally. And other ways would be, say, cupping hands to pull carbon dioxide, to bring carbon dioxide up in the lungs, to increase it in the blood, to improve blood flow to the brain. Because I think we need to calm the central nervous system, which is the brain.
Yeah.
And we can do that by improving blood flow to the brain. But we don't do that by breathing hard and fast. So, yeah, it must be very frustrating when somebody has got a racing mind and is in a state of anxiety, and they are told to do mindfulness, because it must be absolutely impossible to do unless the respiratory physiology is addressed. You know, I think we have to go a lot deeper with this in terms of the application of breathing. I really do, yeah.
So Robin, how do you in your business now, because have you brought, I mean, obviously to some extent your business, I mean, tennis mindset into business. I mean, tennis players seem to have a good mindset for that. So, but how do you keep your boundaries now, like with your background, so you don't get that tunnel vision of just, you know, working 15-hour days? Because I know you got a lot of things going on. So how do you incorporate your recovery habits into your daily life now?
I mean, it's not that difficult, because, you know, even if I feel better now than in a long, long time, I would say that, you know, I just couldn't do it. You know, I just feel like it's not worth it to work 15, 16 hours a day. And I really try not to compete with others. You know, I always try to only compete with myself. And you know, one good thing that really works for me is to say that, okay, what can I do? I can only do my best. And then there's not up to me. You know, I can always try my best in every situation. And if it works, great. And sometimes it doesn't work, okay, I will always get another chance. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of not trying to take everything, every little detail, every small thing as serious as I did as a player. You know, you can still do a really good job, and sometimes, most of the times, an even better job.
So doesn't it go back to what you said initially, that which is very, very, very difficult to be 100% on the court during practice and during matches, and then try to switch off, especially mentally, off court? But that is, like you said, that is very easy to say. Mm-hmm. But once you've played a match, if you win, you think about the next one. If you lose, you think about why you lost. So no matter what you do, tennis is a thinking sport. You have so much time to think, and you got your opponent against you, the referee, the crowd, your coach. So it's a thinking sport. So it's very tough to just put it on the court and then outside. But I think there are players who are able to do it, but it's very, very, very difficult.
Yeah, I think there is. Not many, but I think there is. And this is probably the players that would have the longest careers. You know, there's so many players I've spoken to now after I retire and after they retire, you know, especially when I came public and spoke about my mental health problems. You know, so many players contacted me and said, you know, I had the same, you know, I retired because of an injury in my knee or whatever, but that was not really the reason, you know, and people feel ashamed about speaking about this. But I know that this is a big, big issue in tennis, in all sports, and in, you know, in life in general. I think this is one of the biggest health problems we're facing in the future.
Well, Robin, I think it's a fault of Western education, and I'll tell you why, because society puts so much emphasis on thinking. Yeah. And we go to school to learn how to think, to break information into tiny pieces, to reason, We are taught and trained how to think, but we are not taught how to stop thinking. You know, it's okay developing the mind into a sharp analytical tool. And there's no question that there is a time to think, but there is also a time to stop thinking. There is a time to plan, and there is a time to stop thinking.
And but, I would also say there is a time to feel.
Yes.
You know, to stop and feel and not always think, you know, because sometimes when you just stop and you know, stop, try to stop the brain, and instead of focus on what you think, focus on what you feel.
So
many times you have the answer. The answer is not in your head. The answer is inside your body and your feelings.
So do you bring, because you said that earlier on when you were younger, that you didn't, you thought you felt okay, but you didn't know what was going on in the body. Do you bring your attention into your body now?
Yes, every day.
Every day. Do you hold it? Is it something that you do as part of your everyday life, or is it something that you do formally?
No, I do it, you know, sometimes there's a few times a day, but, you know, I always, I would say 99% of the days I wake up, you know, a few years ago, I realized what's the first thing I did when waking up, you know, I reach for my phone, I turn the alarm off, and then I start scrolling Instagram or the news or whatever. And I realized, no, I should not do that. You know, I should take 15 minutes every morning to do the breathing exercises, to do the mindfulness before I get up and reach for my phone or whatever. And, you know, in the beginning, I didn't feel much difference. But after a while, you kind of get into it. And now it's just, you know, I love to do it. Mm-hmm. And I don't even feel the urge to reach for my phone anymore.
Yeah.
But it won't happen overnight. You know, it takes a while. You have to be persistent. You have to do it, you know, give it a month or two, do it every day. It might be really hard in the beginning, but the reward is really good.
I would agree with you. And I think as well, maybe people starting off, they might find it a little bit challenging trying to bring their attention into their complete body, but maybe just to close their eyes and to put their hand out in front of them. And just to feel what sensations in a small body part and just hold our attention there, because it's a great way of getting our attention out of the mind and quietening the mind. But, you know, the human body, it has been tremendous for my life, and by the sounds of it, tremendous for your life, you know, and it's so simple, you know, that we can tap into that calmness of the breath and the body itself to quieten the mind. And it creates great space that by training the brain and by reducing the incessant and repetitive thinking, because there is a time to think, but there is a time when thinking becomes absolutely useless and harmful and damaging. And that's where we need to be able to say, switch off and bring the attention into the body and play tennis with every cell of your body. Sing a song with every cell of your body. As human beings, we often feel that our head is different to the body, and we need to be able to disperse that energy. Yeah, that is great.
Yeah, so many people live in like, they live and think they live in the future all the time.
Yes.
They think about whether they're in this situation, they think about what's going to happen next, and then next, and then next. You know, they never really live in the present. You know, they're always, you know, they're there physically, but mentally they're somewhere else.
Yes, yes.
And then all of a sudden you realize you're 85 years old and you're about to die.
Yeah. Do you feel that life goes a little bit slower when you have your attention and you bring it into the present moment? Because you're kind of more here and connected with life then.
Maybe. I wouldn't say I feel that life is slower, but one thing I noticed that you know, I have a lot more memories. You know, I remember things much better. You know, when I played, I traveled with my at that time girlfriend, my now wife, and she has so many memories. You know, she asked me, "Do you remember when we went to that place? Do you remember when we ate at that restaurant?" I don't remember anything. Because I was there, but I was not there, you know, mentally I was not there, I was somewhere else. I don't have any memories. And that's one thing, you know, I realize with my kids now, you know, I'm so happy I start this. I'm so happy I feel better because, you know, I remember things with my kids. You know, first few years, you know, when I was really bad, our daughter was born straight after. And, you know, for the first few years of her life, I don't remember anything. But then I was feeling extremely sick. I was so focused on myself, you know, what was happening. But it's a big difference now.
What type of, you said you did some breathing exercise or you're doing it right now, because for people who are not used to breathing exercises, there are so many different ways. I mean, Oxygen Advantage has about 26 variations right now. There's box breathing also, there's Wim Hof and so on. Do you do slow breathing or a specific technique, or you switch, or you do the same thing?
I switch. Mostly I do slow breathing. But the thing is, for me, I realized that I don't even have to focus on the breathing. You know, for me, it's just a mindfulness thing. You know, I switch off my brain, and it also gets so much easier now when I practiced it and I feel calmer. It gets easier. I remember, you know, in the beginning, trying to focus on my breathing, you know, I could do it for maybe one breath, 2-3 seconds before I find myself thinking about something else. And it still happens, you know, it still happens, but not nearly as often. And it's so much easier for me now to bring my attention back to the breathing again. So the more you practice, or at least it was for me, the more I practiced, the better I became. And now it's just, sometimes I feel like, you know, I just can't wait until I can do my mindfulness or my breathing exercises. And in the beginning, I was just like, I hated it. Yeah. I really hated it.
Isn't that the problem, that it takes, it's invisible. So you don't see it. So it's not like you're building muscles or you see yourself moving in tennis. But tennis is, in a way, is a good sport because it takes a long time to become good at tennis normally. But you want to do the breathing exercise and you want to feel good right away, 2 seconds later.
Yeah.
When you hear slow breathing is great, but ironically, when you're trying to relax, it could actually activate your sympathetic nervous system, making it worse. So all these things, it seems like you crossed that line, that it takes a few months to get into it, but now it's just second nature for you.
Mm. Yeah, it gets easier. You know, like everything you practice on, with time it gets easier and you become better. But I would never even start it if I wasn't feeling that sick for such a long time. You know, I went to all the doctors, no one could help me. You know, the only thing that really helped, the only thing a doctor helped me with, they gave me like Xanax. And of course, it helped 20 minutes after, I feel much better. But I realized, okay, this is not the long sustainable solution to this. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, you know, no one could. That was also frustrating. No doctor in the world could really help me. You know, I was just hoping in the beginning, as I said, I was just hoping for someone that could give me a pill. And then I was feeling perfect again. But as time went on, you know, I realized that this is going to take time, and I will let it take time also.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Rob,
nobody really said anything to you in those years to really focus on breathing. I mean, sleep is kind of like the basic. I mean, most people understand that you need sleep, but they're very tightly connected. If you don't sleep properly, you don't sleep properly, you don't breathe properly, and the emotions connected with that. So there's like a triangle there, but there was no doctor who kind of explained that to you in detail on what to do.
No.
I think it's only starting to happen, Daniel. We see it in breathing, and the year 2020, something amazing has happened. I really do. I have one of my dogs is after coming up the stairs. So I do have a separate office space, but trying to keep the doors closed down below is a different story. It's sleep was becoming a hot topic 5 years ago. And breathing now is really, really good out there. And I find it amazing. Like, as Daniel said, you know, there are so many different breathing exercises. If we want to upregulate, there's exercise. If we want to downregulate, there's exercise. If we want to calm the mind, there's exercises. like the slow breathing, of course, is brilliant. You know, even down to 6 breaths per minute to stimulate the vagus nerve and improve heart rate variability. But looking at breathing to improve blood flow, because I remember, I don't know if you experienced cold hands. That used to be something that I always experienced. And cold hands is something that's very common in people who have slightly faster and upper chest breathing. And I remember I came across, of course, breathing just for my own health. I read it in a newspaper article in 1998, and I practiced slowing down my breathing, but I practiced breathing less air. Because if you breathe less air, carbon dioxide increases in the blood, and that opens up blood flow. But I was able to bring temperature, a warmth into my hands, and I'd increased watery saliva. And straight away then, after a while then, there was another exercise I found to open up my nose, and it worked. And I couldn't believe this, because I always thought breathing was take the full big breath, or, you know, what you often are told, or what people hear, you know, you hear people say. But I never realized that you could open up airways and do things like that. And the one thing that I will come back to, I taped my mouth that night back in 1998, taped my mouth closed, and I wore Breathe Right strips over my nose. And the first morning I woke up, and I was kind of getting used to it. It was the second morning I woke up. I repeated taping my mouth again that night. I used 3M 1-inch micropore tape. That was at the time. And I woke up. It was the best night's sleep I had in 15 years. And nobody told me to breathe through my nose. And I think it was because maybe I, like many others, we were in that state of constant sympathetic drive, constant fight or flight. And society does. Like, I feel sorry for the kids growing up here. There's a load of pressures. You as a tennis player, like, that's a huge psychological pressure that's putting on. And, you know, the thing, when I'm nearly 50 years of age, you know, the one thing what happens when you're hitting 50, you don't give a damn, honestly. And you don't give a damn what people think. And there's a great freedom in that as well, you know.
Yeah.
And there is things that you spoke about earlier as well, that you get out of bed and one thing that you might be doing is looking at your Instagram. And can you imagine the number of youngsters and 20-year-olds, and they're surrendering all of their attention to a social media platform. And the most beneficial thing that they could be doing in the world is don't surrender all of your attention. Don't give your time to these big platforms. Bring some of your attention inwards. Mm. Bring it inwards. Because there's an intelligence going on in the human body that we need to be connecting with. And it does improve focus and concentration. You never waste your time with this one. But as Daniel said, breathing, it doesn't seem as if we're doing anything dramatic. Like, it's not as if we're shouting and roaring or nothing. It's all peaceful. It's all quiet. And that's the way it has to be. But probably that's why it doesn't get the attention. Because it's not something that you can visually see in huge, you know, drama. Mm. But in terms of what's going on there, the power is enormous.
And also, I think the kids, you know, kids nowadays, I think they use their phone, or they want to distract themselves, because as soon as they start to shift their focus, you know, to themselves or within themselves, you know, they feel this little bit uncomfortable feeling. And that's, you know, when you do it without even thinking about it, you know, you try to distract yourself from not, you know, looking inside.
Yeah, I think so too. And I suppose,
I mean most thoughts are, I mean, up to 90% are subconscious thoughts. So you do it without even thinking about it. So really you need to go back and, like, it's all to do with your habits if you want to change that. So it you can see it everywhere. Like, if you told somebody 20 years ago that people would go in with their cell phones all the time, you wouldn't believe it. But now it's just normal. Mm. So it's you don't see it because it takes so many years to change, so to speak. But what a few final questions for you, and with regards to tennis, what do you miss from tennis? Do you miss those kind of cutthroat situations where you're in a final or a big tournament where you know there's only a few minutes that where you're going to lose or win or make your final, win a big tournament? Do you miss that at all?
I do. Sometimes I do. Yeah. And the funny thing is, you know, those things was the things that I felt mostly, you know, tired of, you know, that was the thing that was really draining me. But it's also now the things that I miss most. So it makes me kind of think that, you know, this is not dangerous. It's not unhealthy to feel pressure on and off sometimes. You know, I think we're humans, we're built for it. It's just that when it happens every day, you know, throughout the whole year and then year after year, that's when it becomes bad for you. But it's difficult, you know, the things I experienced during my tennis career, it's difficult to get those feelings going in on a full stadium, playing a Grand Slam final in front of 15, 20,000 people and many millions of people watching on TV. It's difficult in a regular life, so to say, to get those feelings. And then, of course, sometimes I miss them a lot.
Is it that the paradox that you miss those pressure situations and that's what gets you? Because the whole key is you can't switch on and off. You can't have them all the time.
Exactly.
Because, you know, it's the pressure is too high. But at the same time, that is what you live for. Yeah. I mean, so it's the paradox of... I miss tennis for that reason as well, even at the level I played at. So I can actually relate to that. So
but the thing is, it doesn't really matter. At least for me, I wasn't more nervous playing a Grand Slam final compared to what I was playing a quarterfinals in a regular tournament in Sweden when I was 12 years old. It was the same feelings. So it doesn't really matter what level you're at. You know, it's just those feelings is why I love sports. But it's, again, it's difficult. And tennis has a problem there, you know, as we spoke about earlier, there's no real off season. There's no room for players to really rest. There's just tournaments for 11 months. They have 1 month where they can maybe rest for 1 or 2 weeks, then they have to train again. It's just, I mean, it's a problem for the sport. And I think, you know, with shortening the season, I think we will see, of course, a lot less injuries, and we will also see better tennis.
Yeah, but do you also think that this experience has helped you in many ways? Because now in business, like men in your age would just go all in on everything, and I want to do this, I want to do that, and not stop to think, because they're in business. It's really no difference in tennis to some degree. It seems like that experiences you've had now has helped you a lot, because now you can kind of... You can recognize symptoms. You can recognize when
for sure. And maybe not only in business, you know, in my life, I would never be the person I am today if I didn't go through all this tough years during my life. Of course, it feels strange to say that I'm happy I went through this. And of course, I'm not happy because it was a terrible time. But in one way, I kind of am, because I would never have changed and I would never improved as a person if I didn't go through this.
Isn't that also the paradox, that if you have to push, you have to push the envelope?
Yeah.
Because you can't, and that's what Patrick and myself are now, when we try to reach athletes, how do you talk to somebody like a Robin Söderling when they're 25?
It's just a shame that you have to.
I think that's the paradox as well. So I don't. Now we're gonna, when we try to reach other people, how you do it, because after the fact they can always look back, almost like you're a different person, and say, "Of course I should have done that."
Yeah.
But once you're there, you're not. Your mental or your mindset is somewhere completely different. Mm. So it's maybe it's something to some degree to be grateful for, because otherwise. If you don't push the envelope, you may not get to that.
No, I think there's people, you know, they live a whole life like that. You know, maybe they will never be extremely bad. They will never be really, really burned out, but they will live their life like on the edge all the time, you know, and they will not even notice it. But it's just a waste, and it's so a shame.
I think, Robin, I think it catches up. I don't think we can get away with this one. And the other thing is, one final question. If you had have incorporated what you know now back in your career when you were playing tennis, do you think it would have made a difference?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the better I became when I played, the smaller the margin became. Of course, everybody was so good, and you know, all that little advantage I could have would for sure help me, and for sure I would have a longer career and a healthier career. So it's yeah, but I was never taught. You know, I was taught to always push harder, train more. And no one told me about recovery, you know, rest or other things, you know, doing things, take your mind off from the tennis once in a while. And I think it's still that way a little bit. It gets better, but it's still the same way, you know. Coaches are, you know, you kind of premieres the ones that are working hardest, that are the ones that are training the hardest and never complains.
Because if you hadn't had the experiences, you would have coached the way you were brought up. This is the way you play. Now you coach in a different way. So it makes sense. If you coach based on your experiences, how to become a top player. So it makes perfect sense. And my final question to you is, so of all those years, all the wins you've had, which win was your best memory? Was it a specific match? So many classical matches.
I mean, overall, I think the best memories I have from my career is the ones I had in the beginning of my career, breaking into the ATP Tour. You know, I was playing with a lot less pressure. You know, I was never the favorite in any match. You know, I was beating the guys I was watching on TV a few years earlier. But apart from that, I think, of course, maybe the Grand Slams, the two Grand Slam finals I made, and also winning the title in Båstad in Swedish Open, just because it was not a big tournament, but just because it was in Sweden, home soil. You know, I think every year since I was 6-7 years old, I went to Båstad in the summer. I was watching the tournament, and I was dreaming about maybe one day playing there. And all of a sudden, you know, 15 years later, I found myself on the podium holding the trophy, and it was just an unbelievable feeling.
Well, yeah, I can't imagine. Unbelievable career. So I am very happy we could do this, and a really good response. And I hope this could help other tennis players, but not only tennis players, but any sports players. Yeah. There's no doubt that this is coming to the surface a lot in the US as well, in NFL, and also in Premier League, and in also in the corporate world. So this is a generic problem. So I think your responses were fantastic. Mm-hmm. So I think people need to be able to look back before the fact.
Hopefully. And that's why I choose to speak about it, you know. To me, there's no, I really don't want to speak about it, but I know how bad I felt. I know how hard it is. And, you know, to me, if someone would have told me, some other athlete, if I would have someone to speak to, it would have made everything so much easier. You know, that's why I decided to speak up about it. And hopefully if I could help just one player or one athlete or just one person, you know, it's more than enough for me.
Great. I'm done with my questions.
We will leave it at that. And I think that was a great final closure. So thanks very much, Robin. Cool.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
It was nice speaking to you.